Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Thank you very much indeed, as always, for being here. It is a late one this Friday, of course, because of Thursday night European action, a 2-0 defeat to PSV. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments' time with my guest, Philippe Auclair. He's coming along very shortly. Just to give you a very quick update, it's breaking now in front of me as I record. So the story from yesterday involving Pablo Mari, who is on loan with Monza, was stabbed in the back, in the shoulder yesterday in an attack in a supermarket near Milan. One person, very sadly, has died in that attack. He's undergone surgery this morning. It went well. He's expected to be out of action for a couple of months. And just to send him all the best wishes possible, because this is obviously a very traumatic thing to experience on an individual level. The physical scar will take some time to heal, but I'm sure the mental scars will be with him for just as long, if not longer. Of course, there was a quote from one of the Italian newspapers where he basically said, today I was lucky because I saw a person die in front of me. I don't quite know how you get your head around something like that, but he's fortunate because clearly it could have been worse. The person who carried out the attack was capable of doing something as atrocious and horrible as that. He's there with his wife and his son, Pablo Mari, and for them to be there to go through something like that in front of your family, with your family there, I mean, it's just, the whole thing is horrendous and horrific, and deep sympathies are with the family of the person who died. But best wishes to Pablo Mari, and hopefully he can make a full recovery in time from this just crazy, crazy incident. All right, let's get on with the show. Arsenal played PSV last night in Eindhoven. They lost 2-0, didn't play very well. So with me to talk about that and more is Philippe Auclair. Good morning, Philippe.
Hello to you, Andrew. Hello, everyone.
Hello, hello. Arsenal lost for the first time in Europe this season against PSV last night. And I think it's fair to say that we kind of got what we deserved from this game, which was absolutely nothing at all. The way we played was so well below where we've been this season. How do you view a performance like that in isolation, even if, let's say, the last couple of games have perhaps signposted that this kind of a performance was maybe coming somewhere along the way?
I don't think we got what we deserve. I think we got less than what we deserved. To be honest, I think it could have been 3, 4, 5, 6 goals. It was that bad. It's a really difficult one to judge because we've got an expression in French which is ni chèvre ni chou, neither a goat nor a cabbage. I know that doesn't translate particularly well, but it's very hard because, for example, you take the starting lineup and you think that's not the first team, but it's not quite the second team either. Mm. Okay, if we win, we're top of the group, that's great. We don't have this nightmare scenario of having to go through a playoff. But then if we lose, it's not the end of the world, because next game is Zurich at home, should win that. And you can see how it would be very difficult to summon the necessary energy and focus from a group of players who've actually been a little bit on the back foot over the past few weeks. And then you add all that together with also some very indifferent individual performances. And I think everybody had a bad night. And I would say that the players had, but I think Arteta had a bad night as well. I don't think that his team selection made much sense to me.
In what way?
I would have just gone for it with the with a proper, you know, like first 11.
That is so interesting because, like, I've seen a lot of people and a lot of people saying, you know, on my timeline and seeing people discussing, like, why are we playing any of the first team players? We should just sort of play the under 21s or play all the reserves.
Oh, really?
Like, I don't think that's realistic or possible even because there isn't the depth in the squad, you know. But I understand kind of why the, you know, why he might have held somebody like Saka, like Jesus, like Thomas Partey in reserve because, you know, you start these other guys, you give them an opportunity. If it doesn't work, you can bring these guys on and hopefully change the dynamic of the game. That didn't necessarily work. But if you sort of go all in from the start, like you're suggesting with the strongest possible team.
All in, certainly not. I mean, if I look at the first 11, I would say that there are four players there, or there were four players who normally wouldn't be in the first team at the moment, that is, which is rather a lot. And you could, for example, I couldn't understand completely having Edin Ketia rather than Gabriel Jesus, who seems a little bit on the back foot at the moment.
Yeah.
The fact is that also we know that this team doesn't function as well when we don't have the Xhaka-Thomas Partey pairing in midfield.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that this PSV team is actually a very decent team, very dangerous, and that they would go for it. Because they had to. And I don't know, I'm probably old-fashioned about that, but I would imagine that if you can put that to bed ASAP, you could rest. I mean, you know, what are we going to do against Zurich now?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the thing that Arsenal had to play for last night, of course it was a must-win game for PSV.
Yeah.
Arsenal knew, back of your mind, you know, subconsciously, you know that, well, look, even if it doesn't go our way, we've got another home game to make sure we finish top of the group.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, my thinking on this would have been, I think, a little bit closer to yours in terms of, I didn't have any big issue with the team he selected last night, but it would have been more, make sure you get the point you need at least from this game, because then next week, when you're playing FC Zurich, you can rest as many players as you want ahead of a game against Chelsea. And then part of me wonders, like, do you worry too much about the fatigue, the schedule, things like that? The games come along. You know, I always remember, like, in the not-too-distant past, you know, you'd see someone like Chelsea and they're playing a League Cup game against, I don't know, some championship side. And they play a pretty strong team in that game in midweek, and they play a strong team at the weekend. And it sort of feeds into what Mikel Arteta was talking about. Like, you know, these guys, you're going to have to play every 3 days, every 4 days. You know, we can't give you the excuse of a day off here or there. But I did think that perhaps it would have been better to go stronger last night, back yourselves to win against Nottingham Forest and deal with the little bit of fatigue or travel or whatever it is, and that way then you can get to rest players ahead of the game against Chelsea next weekend.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. But obviously, all of this is very easy to say with hindsight.
Of course.
And which is, you know, obviously hindsight is always right. I have to say that I looked at the lineups, you know, an hour before kickoff, and I was a little bit not too sure about that. I think there's a little bit too much movement and not enough at the same time. And especially, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we played with that back four this season.
No, I don't think so.
Like that. You see, that's one of the things, especially we know and we knew how dangerous they were going forward. And I mean, Simon's an absolutely astonishing game, really. What a player he is.
Yeah, it looks good.
It looks very, very good. And they genuinely had a very good game going forward anyway. But I don't really like the idea of having a back four that hasn't been tested, really, apart from on the training ground, obviously, but hasn't been tested in competition before. That's maybe the one thing that I thought,
I mean,
and that's perhaps sending the wrong message as well to the opposition, all these sort of things. But again, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And let's not get, you know, too depressed about that. Sure, it's not the time for basking, which we've done a lot of in the past few weeks, and glory be. And what you can hope is that people will... Probably the expression wake-up call has been used about hundreds of times in this morning's press and blogs. But it certainly is one. And so let's take it like that. It's not a disaster, but honestly, it was a really, really, really poor performance, which also shows that we've got a way to go, which is a good thing to know, inverted commas, that yes, it is a group of players that has been called upon. I mean, we've basically used the same 11, throughout the season.
Sure.
Which I'm in a way contradicting myself, because in a way I'm saying, oh, maybe we should have rotated more, but when we rotate, it doesn't work. So it's like, you know, catch 22 situation. It just shows that we are not quite as strong in depth as perhaps we would like to be. Not quite.
Yeah, I mean, I think
we're not very far from it, but I would say that it's fairly obvious that we miss a kind of another partner for Granit Xhaka in midfield, for example.
Yeah.
Much as I like Zambi, he's not that kind of player. And it shows we have a problem in that area, in games that we are not bossing in particular. So, and in which don't have this necessary approach, which is, by the way, physically a very tiring approach, because we start our games really on the front foot very, very quickly. And we try to keep that tempo and going throughout.
Mm.
And that's obviously something that is bound to have an impact on, you know, the physical qualities and the resilience of the players over a longer season. But again, let's not read too much into it. I mean, the lack of defensive organization was so obvious. It was clear to me that there was a lack of understanding between the players of that back four, and the number of times they could find really easily way past us or through us, it was astonishing. And with a bit more luck, or a bit less luck for us in terms of offside decisions, it could have been a real rout.
Yeah, well, I mean, that back four, I mean, you mentioned it. When you look at it, Tomiyasu, Saliba, Holding and Tierney, I mean, Holding is probably the only one, even though Tomiyasu has been a bit sidelined. He was the first choice last season and clearly a very good player. Saliba's in there. Tierney's in there. You know, these are first choice players. I know Tierney and Zinchenko have been rotating a little bit this season, but Zinchenko hasn't
and
been
Ben
fit.
White would be on the right, you know, and Tomiyasu and Tierney would be up for, you know, it would be Zinchenko, otherwise Tierney or Tomiyasu. Rob Holding has come in a number of times and actually done a very good job when he's come in, usually.
Yeah, not last night. But I mean, the point I was going to make about this was Gabriel has had a bit of criticism, and he's had a bit of made a couple of errors this season, and that happens, you know, defenders make mistakes, simple as that. But I'm looking at that back four and I'm wondering, who is the communicator in there? Who is the leader in that back four? Because as good a player as William Saliba is, he doesn't appear to me anyway, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but he doesn't appear to me to be quite as vocal as you might like. Now, maybe that's just who he is, maybe it's the fact that he's only 21, you know, all of those kinds of things. There is a confidence about the way that he plays, which doesn't seem to be aligned with a level of communication that you would expect from central defenders. Yeah, I'm not saying he doesn't talk, but I'm just wondering, in that situation last night, when there is a lack of organization at the back, who's the guy who's holding that together? And I think that might have been part of our problem.
Yes, and it also shows that when you compare the choices, the permutations are possible for clubs which are direct rivals of Arsenal in the league at the moment, you realize that they have actually more options in terms of their central defenders. And I would suggest that it is one of the few areas in the that you should not rotate too much. It takes a long time.
Mm.
To get a central defensive partnership going. And we have one now. And it's true, from time to time, Gabriel has made a mistake or two here, but let's be frank, we're all extremely happy with Saliba and Gabriel as a pair.
Yeah.
And Gabriel has this presence about him, vocally and physically as well. He's very demonstrative on the pitch, and he's a kind of in-your-face defender as well, which Rob Holding is not, and Saliba is not either.
Mm.
And and also, you know, Tomiyasu, when he's played, has been playing on the left of defence this season, and done a good job, actually, by the way. So Sonny's back on the right. It's like there's too many things happening. None of those things taken individually are terrible, scandalous, whatever you name it, catastrophic. They're not. It's just that it didn't happen. And it might be a mixture of, again, those changes in the defensive lineup. It might be a certain lack of focus because of the very strange, well, of the peculiar nature of this game and what we needed to take from it as compared to what they needed to take from it. Some element of physical fatigue, because it's true that some players have been playing a lot since the beginning of the season. And you add all of this together and, you know, it's basically not our night. No. And I wouldn't say this performance has been coming because it was really abject as a performance. But there have been elements in the past few weeks, I mean, past couple of weeks in particular, which suggest that we need a bit of refreshing somewhere. So maybe it would come precisely because we are about to face the guys, you know, the blue guys. Mm. So that should wake us up. That should wake us up. But otherwise, yeah, it's one of those you'd like to say, let's just forget about it and move on to the next one. But it goes a little bit beyond that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, Mikel Arteta spoke afterwards. I think the words he used said, we need a reset. You know, we were nowhere near our level today. He said we were extremely poor. But talking about a reset, I think, is quite interesting. And I guess it's sort of inevitable, isn't it, that when you have a schedule like this, and I am still a little bit skeptical about the idea of fatigue being, you know, completely to blame for this. I think, you know, last night, it's very difficult to explain why a team that has been so effective this season, and the reason I think they've been as effective as they have been, is like there's an element of precision to the football that we play. The passes are quick. The control is good. It gives you that half a second to step away from a defender and make the next pass. But there was too much of too many poor first controls, too many poor first touches last night, bad decision-making, passes being given away under no real pressure, things that we haven't really done all season. And it's difficult to know what exactly is behind that. I know the pitch was a little bit difficult, but it was the same pitch for PSV. Maybe they're used to playing on it. Maybe they practiced on it. I don't know. If there was some bubbling and slipping and what have you, it strikes me that, you know, a manager who you know, spent a lot of time with Alex Ferguson might well have prepared his pitch for his players and not for the Arsenal players. I mean, I'm not ruling that out. I don't think that's beyond the realms of possibility, no. You know, but I don't think we can use that as an excuse necessarily. But a team that has throughout this season played extremely well, you know, for about 80%, 85% of the season, we've played really, really well. Isn't it sort of inevitable that at some point, when you have given a lot to beat Tottenham, when you've given a lot to beat Liverpool, when you've been away in Norway, away to Leeds, away to Southampton, which is a tricky ground for us, as we know, and then you're away to PSV on a night where they're up for it, a lot of energy at home, they know they have to get something from the game to finish top of the group. So, you know, all of those things come together, bit of a perfect storm perhaps, but it is inevitable that a slip in standards, even if it's only 5%, can look a lot worse, you know, when it comes to, because that's all it is. I don't think it's like we were as poor as I've seen us this season so far, but it doesn't have to be much to make you look really bad. And I think just sort of trying to correct that is what lies next for Mikel Arteta.
And I think also there's another element to take into consideration here, is that I genuinely think that our perception of what is to be expected in a football game is totally warped these days. There's something totally wrong in the way we look at things. The idea of losing 2-0 away to PSV Eindhoven, I mean, there's nothing so crazy about that. We've become so used to see the big clubs literally hammer everything that is put in their path, that we just expect everything in football to respect the kind of logic of the stronger, you know, the fitter, being always the winner. and to a crazy extent. I mean, PSV chased Ajax all the way to the title in Holland last year. They're a good team.
Mm.
And the fact that, you know, and Ajax is a very good team, and including on the European stage, you know, whatever is happening this season, but they're a very good team. So it's like, it's not as if, oh, you're bound to beat those guys. No, you're not. And I genuinely think there is an element of that. It's like, for example, our starting the season in the league is totally abnormal. I'm sorry, it is totally abnormal. It makes no sense. You know, it. Yes, because if you look at after 10 games or 9 games, we were on course. The tempo was over 100 points over the season. That's not normal. But we've become used to that because of the Manchester Cities and the Liverpools and the Bayerns and the PSGs of this world. And we somehow, I think, we project on our own clubs, on our own club, which is nowhere near those guys in terms of financial power. It's not near those guys.
Mm.
We project the kind of logic that we've developed for the super elite teams, and thinking it's normal that these teams should win everything. It's not. Football is totally abnormal in the 21st century. What Manchester City is doing is abnormal. What Liverpool has been doing is abnormal. Bayern, you carry on like that. Totally abnormal. And we are a normal club. We are not part of that super elite. And therefore, we will have nights like this when it shows that we are not the all-conquering, all-singing, all-dancing kind of troupe which is assembled for, you know, hundreds of millions by Manchester City, who can afford to have, you know, Emeric Laporte or Ruben Dias on the bench, you know, this, which is ridiculous. We can't afford that.
I mean, we have spent a lot of money, though, to be fair.
No, we have spent a lot of money, and we've spent it actually wisely.
Mm.
But we haven't spent it over a period of 14 years, like that's been the case for those guys. Or in the case of Chelsea, for even longer than that.
Yeah.
No, we have spent money, and we've actually addressed some of the issues that we had in our squad, because we'd spent unwisely in the past as well. Now, it's true that... But we've spent within our means, by the way, and for anybody who hasn't seen... Swiss Ramble's wonderful thread, when I say wonderful, it's wonderfully rational and explained and clear about the finances of Arsenal and how it is possible for us to spend that much whilst actually being economically viable, not just for FFP purposes, but also for the profitability of the club. Have a look at it. It's fantastic. But what I mean by that is that even if we've spent a lot of money on a number of players, we are not in that category. I mean, maybe I'm explaining myself badly, but I think... we have a problem of perception as to what should be expected. It's not just having expectations which are excessive. It's a fact the expectations are unreal. We are not the reality that we live in terms of this super elite, this new hierarchy in European club football, is so abnormal when you look at it, you know, with a longer lens, that our own perception is skewed because of it.
So do you?
And I'm not saying that it excuses or is finding reason for what happened against PSV. What I'm saying is that what happened against PSV is something that will happen to any club which is not part of this super elite. It will happen. It's just we are so now formatted to believe that there is a kind of natural order in football that. We read too much sometimes. It was just in what is just a bad result. It's not a result that I find worrying, Andrew. I'm more worried about the fact that it comes following a number of performances which were really well below par. That's more of a worry to me than the fact of losing at the PSV.
So, I mean, are you basically saying that because of what the likes of Manchester City have done and what Liverpool have done in a different way. I think it's important to point out that Liverpool have done it in a different way. I mean, still in a way that is out of the reach of 90% of football clubs in all the world, but they've done it a different way to Manchester City. But it's created I don't want to say that standards have been raised or levels have been raised, because I think there's an artificiality obviously about it because of the way Man City have spent money, right?
Yep.
But we know, or we understand now as football fans, that you almost need perfection to achieve success. So anything that isn't perfect feels much more disheartening or discouraging or damaging than it actually is.
Yes, correct. That, absolutely. I entirely agree. Which doesn't mean, again, that there is not an element of the performance last night which is not worrying or preoccupying. But let's not blow it out of all proportion. Again, I think it's more the fact that this comes after a few performances which were sloppy, and again, you're absolutely right. You know, the number of unforced errors and the passing is not as crisp and as fast. The speed at which the ball gets to feet or in the path of the run has decreased, which is one of the first things that I notice when I watch a football game. I'm looking how fast are they shooting at, you know, their passes, or are they just passing the ball around?
Yeah, we've talked about this a lot.
And I think it's an absolutely crucial element. And we have slowed down in that particular area. And obviously, it's very, as you said, the margins are infinitesimal. And if you're, you know, even like 2% down on your normal rhythm, you get punished for it. But again, we could have been punished far worse in far worse fashion than we did. Yeah. We were really, really, really bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think, I mean, something like this, like you mentioned, Mikel Arteta said it's a reset point. And you mentioned, I think, wake up call and things like that, where, you know, we're not quite as deep as we would like to be. So do you think there's something quite useful about this Europa League campaign demonstrating quite clearly that in a couple of positions, let's say, there is still some room for improvement? And, you know, obviously, as we saw towards the end of the window, there were some issues with the squad anyway that the manager would have liked to have had addressed when he talked about more firepower. So we knew we were chasing a winger, you know, Rafinha, Pedro Neto, names like that, being even Cody Gakpo was somebody who was mentioned. Yep. And then, you know, the injury to Partey and Elneny meant we were looking for a midfielder. And I think this perhaps illustrates the need for reinforcements in January. And of course, this season is quite unique in the sense that in a couple of weeks we're going to be taking a break for the World Cup, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But it is a unique situation in that normally in December the schedule is ridiculous. It's so hectic. You're just sort of, right, let's go game to game to game to game, and then you get the festive period and it's like, how are we going to get through this? And then January happens and everybody is sort of reacting to an extent in January, and things go towards the end of the window. Whereas now we've got football managers, we've got football executives, we've got scouts, we've got recruitment people, we've got all of these people who, you know, are going to be not necessarily at a loose end, but certainly with a lot more time to stop and think about where their squad is and who they've got available and what kind of a second half of the season they're expecting. So this January, to me, regardless of what happens between now and the break for the World Cup, and I hope we can obviously keep going and beat Forest on Sunday and get a good result against Chelsea and, you know, go into this World Cup break in good shape, you know, top of or near the top of the table, which is, you know, a good place to be based on expectation levels before the start of the season. But January becomes super, super important as to how we can maintain this, because already you might say we're showing a few signs of not being able to quite maintain the levels, whether it's physical, technical, whatever it might be, for all the various reasons. You can see that it's not quite there at the moment.
Yeah, I quite agree. And the thing is, as well, I mean, I think all that you have said is 100% correct. And I will just add one thing to make it 120% correct, to quote Gianni Infantino, is we have absolutely no idea, and I mean, nobody has any idea where anybody is going to be in around the 20th of December. Absolutely nobody knows. Mm. We haven't got a clue. Because, I mean, we're going to have a number of players going to, obviously, to the World Cup ourselves, in decent teams who could actually be there for, if not the duration, but, you know, they'll be there for a while. Nobody has any idea which physical state the players will come back in, especially playing in this very strange competition. And it's what is true of us and for us is true of all our rivals, certainly in England. Nobody knows. And if you talk to people who are, be it in the physio department or people who are in the scouting department, they will all tell you that they haven't got a clue how they're going to approach the coming window, because a lot will depend on the aftershock of this crazy World Cup. And because the consequences, well, we don't know what the consequences are, because the amount of football we will have played by the time we actually get there is unprecedented in English football history. And I really mean it. It is unprecedented. We will never have played as many games before that, the 15th of November or 12th of November, whenever it is that the players are joining their teams, than we have had this season, because we started earlier than we've ever started. We've had loads of midweek games, which we don't have we don't have usually, because we have to, because of this crazy timing. And on top of that, the European competitions as well. So, it's as I'm like you, I think this January window is going to be absolutely crucial, because in a way we're going to have two seasons in one, and we genuinely are going to have two seasons in one.
I mean, the other side of this as well is that professional footballers don't take a six-week break in the middle of the season, ever.
And
that's, you know, the players who are going to the World Cup, we obviously know the demands that are going to be placed on them, but we don't quite know how, like, most of the players in the world are not going to go to the World Cup. Most of the players in the Premier League are not going to go to the World Cup. But then they have a period in which, obviously, they can train, but there's, you know, a big difference, as we know, between training and competitive football. And how they're going to react, despite, I'm sure, the best efforts of every club. You know, Arsenal, we know, are going to go to Dubai. They're going to play against Lyon. They're going to play against AC Milan. They're going to play against, you know, play these friendlies. And that's obviously important to keep these guys fit and sort of at a sort of match fitness level that allows you to get going again. But we don't know how players are going to react to that, whether we're going to see more injuries, whether we're going to see we might, for sure, and we might see some players really benefit from it, but we might also see some players who because they've had to sort of in essence down tools in the middle of a season, find it very difficult to get going again, or suffer, like you're saying, some injuries because of that.
Yeah, but it's already started as far as the muscular injuries are concerned. I mean, it's complete. It's a slaughterhouse in European football. It's completely crazy. I mean, I'm thinking in particular what's happening to the French team. It's absolutely crazy, the number of players who are out with muscular injuries. And it seems like every week that goes by, another one gets injured, you know. And so this will only add to it. And to be honest, yes, physios are really tearing their hair out, what's left of it, because there is no way you can plan for that, because it's never happened before. And let's hope it never happens again. It's unmanageable. It's unmanageable. And but the thing is that once again, the clubs which have got the financial means that others perhaps don't have will be disproportionately advantaged by this very weird by the transfer market yet again, and perhaps this time more than ever. They'll be able to just to jump in and say, okay, right, we've got so many crocs, we need so many, we've got the money, let's spend it. Stuff it.
I mean, I mean, that brings us to the World Cup, and I know you have some strong thoughts on this. You know, as an event,
and I have shared them on a few occasions.
You have. It's fair to say.
It's fair to say, yes.
I mean, you know, it's such a weird one, you know, because I think there are so many aspects to this tournament that don't stand up to any kind of scrutiny, you know, in terms of decision making, in terms of timing, all of those things. But it's. I suppose the thing is, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, you know, this is the World Cup. I love the World Cup. I love the football. I love the pomp and circumstance of it all. And I guess that's part of why this is sort of problematic for a lot of people, in that, like, you can let yourself just say, well, fuck it, I'll watch the football. It's just a football tournament. I can turn a blind eye to everything else. Mm. But that's part of what, you know, they want you to do, right? I noted the Australian players, the Australian Football Federation released a statement this week about, you know, the entire situation, you know, the World Cup as a whole, that is happening as a tournament, but what it has meant to many people who have gone to Qatar to work, who've lost their lives, all the information. You know, it's a little bit difficult to get exact numbers on certain things, but what did you make of that statement from the Australian Football Federation, and are you expecting others to follow suit, or are they just going to do something like wear an armband?
I think that what the Socceroos did is admirable, because it was very difficult for them to come forward with such a statement. They've struck exactly the right tone. If you haven't seen, you know, people who haven't seen this short video that has been posted on, you know, social networks by actually their PFA, basically, but it's a message from the Socceroos. I think they strike a perfect balance between respect for the people who are hosting the World Cup and nuance in their approach, but at the same time, they're very direct in what they say about the right to unionize, the right to live and survive, and also the situation of LGBTQI plus people in Qatar. And the way they've put that message together, I think, is totally admirable. Will many others follow suit? I don't think so. I think most of the world doesn't give a fuck about it. Let's be absolutely honest about it. The reaction that there's going to be about, that there has been about the Qatar World Cup, and I say that as a veteran. I published my first piece on the plight of migrant workers in Qatar back in 2013, and I don't think many people were doing that at the time. So it's something that I've been pursuing ever since then. And to be honest with you, Andrew, I'm getting a bit sick of it right now, which is why I have very, very little, actually no enthusiasm whatsoever for the tournament, even though I don't think we should boycott it in terms of watching it, but we'll come to that in a second. But the most of the world doesn't care. The criticism that is going Qatar's way, and unfortunately, FIFA's way, but not enough towards FIFA.
Yeah,
there should be far
more
criticism towards FIFA. FIFA is responsible for this mess, 100%. It has come from a handful of countries in Europe, and that's it. In Asia, nothing. In Africa, absolutely zilch. In South America, barely mentioned. North America, that might surprise you, because you would have thought, come on, the USA, Canada. No, it's hardly been mentioned. So it is really something that has been put forward by people, particularly in Scandinavia, where you have seen the attitude of the Danish Football Federation, for example, and Danish players, the Norwegians, who actually held a vote in June to see if they would participate in case they qualified, and you know, the work that my friends at Yozima have been doing, when we'll give a plug to them in a second.
Yes.
About it, and a few independent voices, and certainly in the UK, in Germany as well, from some of the fans. I'm thinking of the Bayern fans in particular. It's really, this criticism has been extremely localized. And so that's a very long answer to a very short question, which is that would you expect many to follow suit? No, but not at all. I expect the English FA to come up with another mealy-mouthed statement, which says one something without saying anything and actually says nothing in the end. Mm. They're specialists in this kind of... if you open the tap of the FA in their hand basin, it always gives tepid water. That's the way it goes with them. We might see something. We'll see something, I think, from Denmark, obviously, as we've already had. And I would imagine the Germans as well. And that's about it, really. And it is actually it is extraordinary, and that, in fact, there should be far more criticism in terms of how widespread it should be. And also, what I find shocking is that there is far too little, almost no criticism of FIFA itself.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, this is one of those situations where I think if you asked football fans in general for their opinion of FIFA, do they think there's questionable decision making? Is there potential corruption, etc., etc.? I think the vast majority of football fans yes. would say, you know what, I think you could be onto something here, you know, based on like yes. all the fucking evidence we've had down the years with previous presidents and, you know, things that you've spoken about, things that lots of people have written about. But is it seen as like an organization that is so big it can just kind of do what it wants, despite the fact that it can hire a nice marketing firm and what have you to put a lovely facade on all the decisions that it makes, and Gianni Infantino can go around the world doing his cosplay in various costumes and fucking kicking a ball here, there, and everywhere as if he's bringing, you know, the beauty and the love of football to, you know, to everyone far and wide, when we know that
noise which you can hear in the background is myself getting hold of a bucket. Yeah,
yeah, well, you know what I mean. But does it, in some ways, what I'm asking is, it like, does it feel pointless to try and take on FIFA? Because, like,
what else is there?
I'm not saying that shouldn't happen, but I can understand why, you know, everyone just go, oh, FIFA. Yeah, well, we know what they're about. Fuck it. You know, what can we do about that? There's a sort of resignation because of the sort of stranglehold that it has over the game.
Yes, no, I can understand that up to a point, but up to a point only. The fact is, it can seem at the moment that it is an organization that is beyond repair. That's what I believe. I believe that it should be disbanded. And I do hope that government agencies and law enforcement agencies will find enough on those bastards to actually nuke FIFA headquarters. In a metaphorical sense,
yes,
obviously,
of course.
you yes. understand what I mean here. But it is not it's not fit for purpose. It is still run like a mafia. It is also run like a dictatorship. Infantino is going to be re-elected in March 2023 with no opposition by acclamation. FIFA is basically both. I mean, FIFA is its own police and judge and jury. Which is not exactly, which is, you know, a bit like Putin's Russia, basically. So they can get away with anything. And this organization is just not fit for purpose. And one huge problem, which of course, you know, when we talk about Qatar 2022, this is also what we should be talking about. Why the hell are we organizing a tournament in a country where it shouldn't take place? And there are no reasons why it should take place there. None. Zero. Bring the cup to the Arab world. What a bloody joke. What a bloody joke. If you want to do that, send it to Morocco, send it to Egypt, have a regional World Cup, perhaps. Why not? But then, and FIFA now has a charter of human rights. Well, okay. I mean, I think every single paragraph in that charter has been violated and is violated on a daily basis in that regime, which is a dictatorship. Right. That's a fact. Why is it taking place in the winter? Because it can't take place in the summer. Oh, shit, we voted for a World Cup in the summer. Why did we change our mind? Well, I don't know why exactly. And you know what? As well, Qatar is organizing the Asian Cup next year in June and July. Can you imagine that? So, I mean, you look around and it's just nonsensical. And why is it nonsensical? It's because of FIFA. It's because of the vote that was taken on 2nd of December 2010. It's because of the lack of moving 4 years later the dates of the World Cup just to suit to make sure the tournament could happen. It's because of Infantino carrying on with the same mafia-like style system. We've changed the name. We haven't changed the way it works. It's exactly the same thing. It's an organization that only responds to itself, that is not accountable to anybody but itself, that has no transparency. It basically is everything that Gianni Infantino says it isn't.
Mm.
And they are responsible for that. They should be getting the flak. The Qataris, think of their regime, whatever you think. You probably can guess what I think of it, and probably an opinion that you will share. But what did they do? They played the game. They played the game whose rules were laid down by FIFA, who chose Russia and Qatar.
Mm.
And FIFA, which is justifying, by the way, I mean, it's just, I mean, I see words are starting to fail me, because unfortunately every single word I can think of is a word that even on Arscast would get beeped out.
No, I wouldn't beep, but I know where you're coming from, and I understand the frustration of, you know, yeah. this it's just like, it goes
it's
back to what I said.
It's as well of it. It's completely crazy.
Yeah, but it's a sense of helplessness, no?
Our planet is bloody burning, and here we are organizing tournaments which is bigger than ever, and which would become even bigger, where this is insane. It's supposed to be the greenest World Cup ever. Obviously, of course it is not. It's just ridiculous. It's in fact, it's going to be the most carbon hungry or carbon producing, rather, World Cup that's ever been. And to the extent that, because they hadn't thought of, oh shit, we've got people who are coming to our World Cup, we better find a place where they can sleep after the games. But since they don't have the infrastructure, and what have they done? They've started a system of air shuttles, which are going to take the fans to the games and from the games, and take them to Oman and Kuwait and Saudi and wherever, where there are actually places where they can stay. So every day there's going to be another 168 flights there and back added to the schedule at Doha Airport, which is already tiny. So that fans can go in and go out. I mean, how insane is that? I mean, what the hell is going on here? We should be looking at making competitions smaller. But obviously, FIFA is this kind of... this gigantic figure of a horned figure in which victims are thrown, in this, the mouth is just an ocean of fire, and you throw things. Moloch, that's what I'm thinking about. That's what I'm thinking about. And it needs more. It needs to consume more. It needs to have more victims, because gigantism is the reason why it exists. It's a cancer that has basically run out of... I mean, yeah, it's just running amok.
Yeah.
The problem is that this cancer is not killing itself. It's killing us, and it's killing our football. So what you do, you whack the thing. And I'm afraid that this is going to be the only thing, is FIFA's got to be exploded one way or another. I am not as pessimistic. I mean, I sound very pessimistic, but I do think it can happen. I do think there are other stakeholders who could have a say in that, who are getting fed up with it. That's the players, for example. That's the smaller clubs, some federations. And of course, there's always the hope that, law enforcement agencies will also catch up with some of the people they haven't caught up with yet.
Fingers crossed in that regard. Very quickly, tell me about the Yossimar International Edition, which is available now. It's a magazine, sort of a World Cup issue, but instead of profiling the teams, they've profiled migrant workers who have been in Qatar, and some of whom have had difficult times there. So can you just give us a quick outline of that?
Yeah, I hate to say, to use the word beautiful when I, speak about something which is devoted to what is a hellscape, but it is an absolutely astonishing feat of journalism, and also it's a beautiful thing to look at and to read. And there's also a photo report and so forth. But basically, my friends at Yossimar have been going in Qatar for a number of times over the past couple of years in particular. Obviously, in quite dicey conditions for themselves. They went as tourists, and then they did what they could to see what it was really like on the ground for migrant workers. And instead of teams, of 32 teams, they've chosen 32 accounts, which are all told in the first person singular, because that's what they wanted to do, is the voices being the voices, unfiltered voices of the people who are there, are paid a pittance, have to work in absolutely awful conditions, are housed 12 to a room without sanitation, proper sanitation, without proper food. I've had to pay agents fortunes just for the privilege of being exploited like slaves in that country. And so it's 32 accounts, some of them quite harrowing, some of them more nuanced, but which add up to, I think, to one of the most powerful exposés on human exploitation that I've ever come across about one of our contemporary societies. And Yoshima has made the choice not to cover the World Cup at all, apart from that angle. It's a very brave, very courageous choice. And it's not cheap. I'm saying that.
Yeah.
It's not cheap to buy it. But the good news, inverted commas, for people who perhaps don't have quite the money to pay for this, is that there is an online edition available as from today.
Oh, great.
Which is great, which people can, and, you know, please do, you know, I'm on my knees here, because FIFA doesn't need money, but Yoshima does. And without Yoshima, FIFA can carry on doing its dirty work. And we, because I'm a member of that team, and we're trying to make our best to make their life as difficult as possible.
All right.
At least to remind people of what football is about in 2022. So
Sure. Thank
you very much for letting me having this, putting across the case for Yoshima and the work that we are doing and that they particularly they've done for the World Cup.
For sure. We will. I'll put links in the show notes and on the website. People can have a look.
They
can
kind.
Get the print edition and also the digital edition, which is available from today. Finally, can we talk about table football?
I was wondering if you would broach the subject.
So
we can.
Yeah.
What is called baby foot in French.
How do you say it again?
Baby foot. Baby football.
Okay.
Baby foot. Yeah.
Well, you were playing midweek against a fairly famous name. People might have heard of this this guy, Arsene, who? Arsene Wenger, I think his name was.
Yes.
How did it go for you, Philippe?
I was trounced. I opened the scoring with quite a nice move on the right wing in particular, and Arsene, being the winner that he is, absolutely trounced me afterwards. But I do think he played fast and loose with some of the rules and regulations.
Is he a spinner? Is he just a multi-spinner?
Yes,
yes. Oh, and I
told
can't
him,
have that.
Pas de roulette, no spinning, please. I also reminded him that goals scored from midfield normally shouldn't count. It should be counted. But of course, where did he score his goals for? From midfield.
The Granit Xhaka of table football, eh?
Absolutely. And so he beat me 5-1. It was really quite frustrating. But it was also great fun and totally surreal because I certainly wasn't expecting on a Tuesday evening in London to play table football with Arsene Wenger. With Patrick Vieira looking over his shoulder and having a good laugh at us as well.
So he had an assistant as well. Not only was he playing, he had an assistant manager
absolutely.
In Patrick Vieira.
Oh, by the way, I've got a little insight into, thanks to this table football thingy, because, I mean, it was basically a small do at the French ambassador's residence.
And ooh la la.
Which was, Ben Paddy was the guest of honor, and Arsene was around, David Dean was around. A few Crystal Palace players were there too, and some youngsters who'd come from the Parisian banlieue as well. It was actually really nice, really sweet, quite low-key. But among the people who was there was Nicolas Jaubert, you know, our set-piece specialist.
Yeah.
And I put him the question that I've always wondered. I said, why is Gabby Martinelli, perhaps the best header of the ball, taking corner kicks for us?
And
he said, that's a very good question.
Did he give you an answer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. He said, they've done, he's an analyst to start with. He started his career with Montpellier as an analyst.
Mm.
And he said, it's true that in terms of his timing, he said that Gabby is perhaps the best header of the ball at the club. He said his sense of timing is just phenomenal.
From an attacking perspective.
From an attacking perspective. But he also says the quality of his delivery is also truly exceptional. So then it comes to the situation that you are in. There are times when he might not take the corner kicks. It will depend on the personnel which is on the pitch, obviously. But if you've got the first 11, so to speak, because we have got so many players who are actually good in the air and can score from corner kicks, the quality, apparently, they've done the calculations and all the rest of it. He is the best suited to create scoring opportunities in the box on corner kicks, direct scoring opportunities, given the rest of the squad. So it's basically given, you know, give a little, but you gain a lot. And but basically said, yes, that's a good question. That's a question that they've asked themselves, obviously.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah.
And the way they went about it, it's like, no, you've got to think, what do you gain? What do you lose? What you gain is actually more than what you lose. So therefore, it's worth doing it. And it's true, Gabby's delivery, the quality of his delivery is absolutely magnificent, it has to be said.
So there you go. That was worth being beaten 5-1 by Arsene Wenger at table.
Absolutely.
All right, my friend. Well, listen, thank you as ever for your time. Much appreciated. Like I
my
said,
pleasure.
We'll give the Yossimar a good plug and people can have a read of that. We'll chat to you soon. Thanks, Philippe.
All right. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Thank you very much indeed to Philippe. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Philippe Auclair, at Philippe Auclair. And you'll find links in the show notes today or on the website, the post that has this particular podcast on arsblog.com. You'll find links through to Yossimar Football, the publication that we mentioned, and as a sort of general resource website to look at, which looks at many of the things that are not great in football that go on all the time and get swept under the carpet. The Yossimar Football website is well worth your time. So thank you again to Philippe. Right, I'm going to leave it there for today because we need to get this podcast out for you guys to listen to. We will be looking ahead to the Nottingham Forest game on Patreon. We'll have our usual Premier League preview podcast over on Patreon. That will be tomorrow, Saturday. We'll have that for you probably around midday there or thereabouts. So we'll have that for you on Patreon, patreon.com/arsblog. The Arscast Extra this week is going to be a bit later than usual. It will be recording Monday evening, not Monday morning. For various reasons, we can't do it until then, but we will have that for you on Monday evening. Let's hope it's a good evening after a good performance and a good result again against Forest, which would, of course, keep us top of the Premier League table. Still a very nice place to be. So until then, thank you as always for listening. Have a good one, and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Sky Sports News, and we begin this hour with some incredible transfer news for you. It is official. The world transfer record has been broken. Not just broken, obliterated, pulverized, smashed into smithereens. Elon Musk has bought Twitter for $44 billion. Think of all the stuff you could do with $44 billion. And he bought Twitter. What the fuck is he thinking? Who is his financial advisor? Jamie O'Hara?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.